Brainstorm Brewery is brought to you by GatheringMagic.com and CoolStuffInc.com. Show your support.
Listen to your podcast for the last few months, and I'm happy with life so far. Sometimes I like to cry in the shower, fully clothed in the fetal position. That only happens when your podcast does not come on, usually during holidays. I have a framed picture of myself and my dead cat of 10 years. The cat was already dead in the picture. I hope I creeped you all out a little, because of this is facetious anyway. Love the show, though. P.S. I do not own a cat. This message was brought to us by listener Conley Razor. We just found out tonight that we actually had comments on MTGcast that we hadn't responded to because we did not know where they were there. We'd been responding to comments on Twitter and Facebook and brainstormbrewery.com and gatheringmagic.com. We didn't realize that MTGcast actually had a comment field, so we just discovered this tonight. Conley, if you're listening, thank you for the comment. It made all of our nights.
You should have heard Ryan's initial reaction to that. He was bawling over.
Oh, man, I was losing it. It was still great the second time, but not nearly as good a reaction.
Oh, it was really that you could tell by the tone in somebody's voice that they were urinating on themselves, but I found that out tonight.
Anyway, so that's the welcome to this week's podcast. Probably hoping for something better, but instead you got fetal position in the shower with dead cats.
How could somebody hope for something better? What could possibly be better than that comment?
Probably nothing. Or everything.
That doesn't, Corbin, shut up.
Oh, man.
That was really deep, man. So for those of you listening, we didn't actually fire Corbin for real. If you'll notice, he has joined us. We were just trolling everybody. We thought that would be funny.
Did you guys continue that on? Because I saw
there were a few people who asked me what was going on. So it was just, we actually thought what was going to happen was that we were going to have a guest on tonight and I would be unable to make it because of work, change of schedule. So, you know, that didn't work out that way. But anyway, so that would have been our fun joke that didn't quite pan out. But so you guys are stuck with me instead.
Pretty much for the duration, as upsetting as that is to most of our fans and 3 out of 4 people on the podcast.
So what are we going to talk about? Yeah, like Corbin. You should have seen it when we did those interviews over at the Gen Con. Corbin was a beast out there, you know. That's where he shines at, doing the interviews.
That's definitely Corbin's wheelhouse, which is good because Ryan and I kind of looked at each other and saw how much fun you guys were having interviewing people, and we just didn't get it. But it's good that you guys have that strength.
I had more fun doing that than trading. I was like, this is miserable.
I enjoyed both. But it was fun doing interviews. I actually have, first of all, thank you, Marcel. Second of all, next year when we get to Gen Con, which I guess is just a few months away now, we have some good plans if there's enough people there to interview. Do it a little more in depth, hopefully, this time.
Yeah. Although, you know, I feel like Marcel being nice to you there was just a really, I don't know, shined over way of saying that you should stick to the casting and so on and so forth instead of playing this game.
Damn, look at Ryan reading between the lines.
I'm glad someone
reading.
Shut up.
All right. So
another
piece of reader feedback we got this week comes from Sander van der Zee in the Netherlands, which hopefully I'm getting that name at least semi-right. But what he is interested in hearing from us is something we've talked about in the past, but it's been a while, and certainly not since we've come to Gathering Magic, is kind of just the Magic Finance 101. You know, every week we talk about what cards we think are going up, what cards are going down. But we haven't, you know, at least in a long time, talked about just kind of the basics of, okay, you have a collection of these cards. How do you manage that collection? How do you, you know, turn it over from season to season? How do you make some money doing this? So that's kind of what we want to focus on tonight. It's just, you know, at the beginning of your speculating or trading career, and it's good for even people who are kind of old hands at this. So, you know, get a refresher. It never hurts.
Very true. So where do we want to start with this, guys? Actually, before we start this, we should
go ahead, read the guy's email.
Yeah, okay. His email is hello, Brainstorm Brewery Crew. That's us. Longtime listener, first time writer. First off, I'd like to say I enjoy your show thoroughly. I hereby hope to avoid the stereotypical loving the show line. Anyway, Magic Finance interests me. It has to. Why else would I listen to a show about Magic Finance? As true as that may be, I don't have any real finger on Magic the Gathering finance soup, so to speak. Not because I lack an interest, but because I lack know-how. I need a Magic Finance 101. I think Brainstorm Brewery could help its listeners out a little. I am not the only listener who's on the verge of getting into the Magic Finance world. What we need is a basis. It's good to know which cards you think are down too low at the moment, but we need to know how to get started. What's a good starting budget? What should we invest to grow? How do we trade effectively, and with who do we trade? Where do we trade? How do you get around people constantly price checking? The differences in the Europe and U.S. markets, and then the issue of cash buyouts. When do you buy out? What do you buy out? Who do you buy out? How do you handle shipping costs? All these questions are on my mind. So tonight, I guess we just kind of want to, you know, obviously these are very big subjects that take a lot of time to talk about and get into in depth. I think maybe tonight, if you guys agree with me, as far as the, you know, say you're new and you have a budget, how do you set your budget? What are the first cards you buy? What do you invest in, you know, when you're just getting started?
Okay, before we move on, I really would feel remiss if we didn't address the fact that I think finger in the soup has got to be some sort of regional idiom. He said that. He's like, I don't really have a finger in the soup. He's like, good, keep your finger out of my soup, dude. That seems like a good thing.
Probably makes sense to the people in the Netherlands.
Oh, they're like, oh, he doesn't have a finger in the soup. Good. They're taking notes already. I have no idea what's going on. That tripped me up more than anything else he said. Everything else sounded fine. It's like, cool, we can talk about that. Wait, whose soup are you fingering? What's going on here?
If you went to Europe and were like, you know, I've just got this spaghetti I'm going to throw on your plate and let you choose what to do with it, they wouldn't know what you're talking about. But in Oklahoma, that's a real thing.
What? Wait, what? What was that you just said?
Yeah, what was this?
Man.
Let me throw this spaghetti in your plate and let you play with it.
Yeah, if you said that outside of Oklahoma, like maybe on a national podcast, perhaps 3 out of 4 people would know what you were talking about.
That's sexual harassment. Play with my spaghetti.
Keep your finger out of my soup and keep your hands off my noodles and we'll be good.
It's a different culture, all right? Because we're talking about Oklahoma, and I walked out of the gas station yesterday where the clerk and another person in there, I walked by, and the piece of the conversation I heard was this. It was, you know, the Confederacy's Constitution is really quite well written. That's what I heard. So that's the type of people you're getting these sayings.
Well, how can you argue with that?
Except for the part about, you know, enslaving people, I'm sure it was written very well. But anyways, it's semantics. Okay. Move on.
So we're in the Magic 101. Do you guys want to start? What do you think is a good place?
Well, I think we want to pretend that we're this guy and we've got no card stock, but we have an amount of money that we want to start investing. So how much would you guys say you should probably have together before you want to start using your money to invest financially in Magic cards? What do you think is a good starting amount?
500.
I say you can do it with $100 to buy a box of cards.
That seems like a terrible way to do it.
Why not buy a booster pack?
Oh, ouch. At retail price?
And pack to power. Like,
I'm suggesting that, you know, don't assume that, you know, not everyone is, say, a speculator who just wants to spend their $500 in a cash buy. Maybe they're a player who's just trying to use Magic to, you know, kind of get in the finance side to kind of make the hobby pay for itself a little more. And as far as starting a trade collection, I think buying a box is not a terrible way to go. If you buy a box of the newest set when it comes out and start trading those things, say if you bought Gatecrash in the first week and traded off the high-priced cards in it into, you know, RTR stuff, that would be an easy way to make your collection bigger and over the long term more valuable, or at least over the medium term, you know, 6 months or so.
Sure. So why don't we say we're going to start with $100 or whatever the Dutch equivalent of that is, and if you wanted to do more, like Ryan suggested, maybe 500 or 600, just take our advice and do 5 times as much of it, I guess. So I think 100 is a good base point.
So do you think there's different entry levels? Some people are in it just for purely financial trade. Some people are in it for a player. And starting off, is there going to be different goals? So do you think the box may be good for the player, but what if someone is purely in it for the financial reasons?
I think, honestly, a box either way isn't the way to go. I think, yeah, I mean, if you're right on top of it and you can get those things going the first week, that's great. But if you're just starting out in finance, you're not going to necessarily know what cards are going to go up, what cards are going to go down. Like, you don't have any history, anything like that. So I don't think a box is necessarily the best idea. I mean, who knows? Like, you know, Boros Reckoner, sure, that was a great thing to get rid of. But, like, how do you know when to sell it when if you're just new into it? Like, is it going to spike higher? Is it going to go lower? Like, so I think really what you want to do is take cards that have had proven histories of going up during certain seasons. Like, my example would be like going into standard PTQ season, maybe pick up the cards that are, you know, semi underpriced in standard. And you can find those sort of things out from, you know, listening to the cast and stuff like that. I think it's a much better investment than going into a box because you really do have to move it quickly. And if you don't know what you're doing, it's going to be more difficult.
I'm with Ryan on this because if you guys will remember, I did an experiment with Gatecrash. I didn't pre-order anything from Gatecrash. I spent my speculation money that I had set aside on cards from Return to Ravnica and older that I thought Gatecrash could improve, and I was very happy with the results. There's less risk because the stuff isn't going to tank necessarily in the short term because its price is pretty well established. And it could pretty much only go up. Whereas stuff from Gatecrash, it's all pretty much going to go down as we approach Redemption and after. Unless you have something like Boros Reckoner, but nobody really saw that one coming. So I'm actually with Ryan. I think you should probably not buy the newest set. I would buy stuff that has a proven history.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, when I say buy the new set, I guess my intention for that was you trade it into this stuff because it's overpriced, and then you trade it into the underpriced stuff. But yeah, I think both methods we're suggesting get you to the same point, which is to buy the stuff that has upside rather than the stuff that has downside. So, you know, whether you're opening a box of new cards to trade for that older stuff or whether you're just simply buying the older stuff with cash, you want to kind of give yourself upside on the collection there. So, for instance, I know excited about Champion of the Parish when Gatecrash came out, and I got in on a ton of Champion of the Parishes when they were around $4.50, $5 retail price. I got in a bunch of them at $4, and I sold a bunch of them last week at $5. So, you know, I got in on them at $4 trade, which equates to, you know, roughly $2 cash, and I sold them at $5 cash. So I think that getting into that older stuff that has upside is, you know, probably where you want to be rather than getting the new stuff.
There's definitely less risk attached to it because it's not all likely to go down. And if you'll listen to the podcast we did last week, I think that's a good example where we went through a lot of the stuff from Return to Ravnica that we think is underpriced. And there's a lot of similar stuff. The same arguments we made for those cards could be made from stuff from Innistad block as well. A lot of that stuff is not really going down necessarily in the short term very sharply, but some of it is going to go up as time goes on, especially something like Parallel Lives, which, you know, I could see approaching $5, maybe even $10. And it's still cheaper than it's going to be right now. So that would be a good example of maybe something that's a little more stable. And we'll talk a little bit more about another set, maybe in a future installment of the cast.
True. Well, actually, since we kind of skipped over what is typically the first segment of our cast, maybe we should use our pick of the weeks this week to talk about some of those cards that we think are great picks right now to be, you know, if you're getting in and you want to look for something that you can invest some money in. And, you know, most of the things that we invest in are slightly longer term flips, but for somebody just getting in, they're going to want something that, you know, they can buy today and in 2 weeks sell for more money. So, like, is there any cards that you guys can think of right now that would be good for the quick flip, even if it's only for a few dollars?
I actually have one I want to talk about. It's Assemble the Legion. Now, this is a card that had a little bit of hype initially, but rapidly kind of approached bulk status despite a few people kind of toying with it. And this was a pretty popular card on Twitter. A lot of people were talking about its power, but it only finally really caught on this weekend in a few Aristocrats builds and a blue-red-white Boros Reckoner deck called the Legion that I believe was played at the GP in Verona to a top 8. So Assemble the Legion is currently about $2 on Cool Stuff Inc. I actually don't even think that's a terrible buy-in price. If you can get them cheaper elsewhere, definitely snap them. People aren't going to necessarily know that this is $2 when you're trading. But even if you did trade for it at $2, that's like a buck cash. That's still a good buy-in price. I could see this card hitting $5 pretty easily because I really think it's got the goods. And I think it does a lot of things that are hard to deal with, first of all. It really kind of laughs at the best wrath in the format right now, which is Supreme Verdict. And I think it does a lot of things in the Aristocrats deck that quickly get out of hand, especially if you're running something like Blood Artist. So We called this a planeswalker earlier, or, you know, the closest thing we're going to get to Bitter Blossom. And I think people playing with that and jamming this in a few different archetypes really bore that out. So I think this is a good pickup around two.
Yeah, I have to agree. my card also is around $2. I think that Lotlith Troll, with the reemergence of all these mid-range decks, and we're getting a lot more like in combat right now, and less, you know, I don't want to call them cheaty decks, but less of the like comes into play craziness. You know, we have some Reanimator and stuff, but it's really died down a little bit. I think that Lotlith Troll has a great position right now. It allows you know to be trampling over and so on and so forth, but also just the regenerate to get around all these wraths. Like you said, Supreme Verdict being like the biggest wrath right now in Standard. Lotlith Troll is another great answer to it. And gives your mid-range, you know, a little more reach in addition to the aristocrats and stuff like that that you can get down on turn two.
Yeah, I've noticed this is a four of in that Brian Kibler green-black deck. So if you compare the, you know, Lotlith Trolls like $2 to the fact that Predator Ooze is like five or six, I think Lotlith Troll's got nowhere to go but up. I think people are starting to brew with Troll a little bit more than they were before. It kind of died down, but I think it's pretty high right now. That's a good pick.
It was actually in Grand Prix Verone. They got a deck there with a Craterhoof Behemoth and, oh, no, it wasn't Lotlith Troll. Sam Black, actually, he had a deck that he was talking about that he had. It had Lotlith Troll and...
I think some of the Junk Rights builds, like the new Reanimator-type shell that you're talking about, I think a few of them ran Troll. I think Ryan was running in his Seance build, which is very similar to this new Junk Rights deck in its construction, and that was a very good discard outlet.
Absolutely. And it lets you keep the early pressure on while still having a blocker if you needed it.
And, you know, having something that'll survive a wrath and all of that good stuff.
Yep. So how about you guys? Any picks that you think are good to buy in at for short-term flip?
Short-term, actually, I don't think so. I think things are just, like, settled in and, like, your short-term flip's going to be a small flip. I don't think it's going to be as really much going on in terms of that. But, I mean, I would say pick up the birthing pods, if anything. If you want to do something that's a safer bet and more of a speculation, that's not going to be really a bad one on a long term, and something to, you know, stack towards or trade away cards that you got that you want to just sit on, you know, move cards that are for good trade value. A birthing pod is like what, $4 now on Cool Stuff Inc.
It's silly how low birthing pod is. Like, really, guys, trust your gut. If you look at a card like that and say there's no way this should be that cheap, you're probably right, and it probably won't stay that way for long.
Especially today's market.
Yeah, and I mean, I believe we all talked about this. Ryan had as a pick a week, but it's just like it's absurdly cheap, and it's like it's going to stay that way. Modern Masters is not going to reprint this card. You're not going to see it come back. So, you know, cards like this, like that, or like Ink Moth Nexus that have a specific, you know, role to play that isn't likely to going to see a reprint for some time. You know, those are good cards to get for at least for like a year or so out, because you could see the spike and this card will definitely be one of those.
Yeah, and that kind of leads into my pick of the week, which is Eye of Ugin. It's from Worldwake, and it's up, man, pretty much 15, almost 20% in the last week. And the reason I suggest this card is because it's a mythic referencing a set-specific thing, which is Eldrazi. And, you know, it's played as a one-of in a lot of modern decks, and it's played in a lot of EDH decks, and I imagine some casual decks, too. And it's just one of those that seems extremely unlikely to be reprinted anytime soon because it references specific things. And, you know, you can pick it up for around $5 to $6 right now. And I think that's a really good price to buy in. And the reason also that I picked this card is it leads into kind of one of the next things that is there as part of my Magic Finance 101, which is seasonality. Modern cards right now are very expensive because we're in modern season. Standard cards are kind of cheap right now, which is like all the Return to Ravnica stuff we talked about. Modern season actually ends here in the next week or two, and the season is when the PTQs are all happening and people need it for their decks. Now, there's still some modern GPs and stuff like that throughout the year, but for the most part, all the demand for modern is kind of condensed into the PTQ season.
For the listeners, so we could do the Magic 101, the PTQ seasons, we want to break that down, basically.
Yeah, the way the PTQ seasons work is, you know, that's like the one we're in right now. Modern season runs in the winter, and it qualifies, you know, the PTQs. It's when all the PTQs are of a particular format, in this case, modern, and they qualify you for the Pro Tour, you know, whatever, whichever Pro Tour down the road. So during the winter, you have modern. During the spring and summer, it's standard. And then in the fall, it's sealed from whatever the newest set is. So really, a lot of one of the basics of Magic Finance is playing these seasons. So all the modern cards that we've seen spike over the last month, month and a half, they're all really expensive right now because it's modern season. Here in 6 months, those cards, the demand won't be as high and the price will naturally fall off on them. And then you factor in something like Modern Masters being reprinted, which will introduce a bunch of staples into the market. The price on modern cards 3 to 6 months from now is going to be very low, and that's going to create a really good buying opportunity. So kind of the way, the basic of it is, you know, when you're outside of modern season, you buy the modern cards and you sell them during the season. And it's like right now is the time to pick up the underpriced standard cards, like the Return of Ravnica stuff, in preparation for the standard PTQ season here in a few months. So that's that seasonality and playing the seasons is, there's a lot of built-in money there that you really takes no, you don't have to have any special abilities. You don't have to be really good at calling cards. All you have to do is play the season. And I
think what this does is it exploits the sort of tunnel vision that people playing the game have, where they focus heavily on what they need to play in their season. And the good part about this is picking stuff up at a seasonal low is you don't have to be right about everything, because the stuff that doesn't go up because of demand during the season will be about the same price that you paid for it. And you'll be able to out it with low risk of loss. So what you're right on, you're going to make quite a bit of money when the demand goes back up and the price goes back up. And the stuff you miss on, it's still very low risk. You're not going to out it for much less than you paid for it, if less at all.
And you can count on this. People are sheep and they just blindly follow the powerful decks or what's hot or what's now. And, you know, the people play and they want to be these tournament players, but they don't think about long-term buying cards that they may need in the future when they're low and they may not be as popular. Or, you know, you'll see some high-powered cards that are just not being played, like, say, Armando Worm that we were talking about, or maybe Dustmantle Seer that are just not seeing the play but have a lot of potential. So, you know, that gives you good opportunity to get in while they're cheap, because they will be powerful later on. Like, we got Falcon Wrath Aristocrat here, you know, reaching $30 online and whatnot. So
yeah, and like it's really particularly evident in modern, at least it has been. Like if you look at a year ago or even 6 months ago, Cryptic Command, everyone remembers how strong that card was. Everyone knew how strong it was, but the format was just in a place where Cryptic Command really wasn't that good. But everyone, you know, who kind of was looking into it knew that there's just no way this will hold. And, you know, since the card is more than doubled since then, and that's, you know, that's really, that wasn't a difficult call 6 months ago. And now, you know, like Marcel mentioned, a few cards that are kind of like that for Standard, even if it doesn't necessarily, Standard doesn't have the upside that Modern does, those cards are still there. And 6 months from now, those cards will be there for Modern again. So yeah, that's a big part of what we do, is not, you know, buying 1,000 copies of one card and being right on it, or, you know, just trading all day, every day. It's just, you know, making the seasonal calls like this.
So I remember when we had Jonathan Medina on, it was a big hot topic. It was for, I believe, one of the set reviews. I can't call it offhand. But he brought up the topic that he was no longer doing speculating. And he thought speculating was bad. And there's a big discussion we had between everybody about he had certain outs. And as a trader, you have other outs. And how much do you, you know, speculate in your cards? Or how do you have sure winners that you go towards? Or how do you balance out your portfolio, you could say, or balance out your binder?
I think it really depends on how much time you have to be able to concentrate on trading. If you're someone that, you know, is one time a week going up to your shop for F&M, you only have like standard players maybe, and, you know, say you can't even make every F&M, you're more of like a casual guy who wants to keep their collection going and be able to pay for the next standard season. I think the best idea is really, like you were saying, keep up with the seasons, but on top of that, like, any cards that you think may drop from your standard collection, turn into, you know, either legacy staples or casual cards like the Parallel Lives and stuff that are just only going to go up over time. And I think that's a great strategy for someone who doesn't have a lot of time to, you know, be able to spend at all these major events and stuff like that. But if you are someone who is looking at going to major events, or even is able to play in 1Ks around your area, or an SCG if it comes to your city, or a Grand Prix if it's within a couple hours, then you want to look at more cards that are not necessarily long-term, but are good to be able to pick up now and maybe ship in 3 months when you're at the next event.
Safe and holds, basically.
Yeah.
So. And even if you're not somebody that's looking to sell stuff at the max profit for it, say, like, you would have made more money selling your Thragtusks at 25 than you would selling them now that they're 15. But if you're a player and you didn't feel like selling your playset of Thrag Tusks for $100 and try to buy them back for $60 later because you need your Thrag Tusks every week, you can still set yourself up by success by thinking about rotation before everyone else does. If you are ahead of the rotation and you are trading with the rotation in mind, if you're not using those Thrag Tusks maybe 2 months or 6 weeks before the rotation, and everyone's going to start trying to get rid of their stuff 3 weeks before rotation, if you're a little bit ahead of that, you can maximize what you get for the stuff that you're going to out.
Right, and I find that time typically comes in August for me, because September new set comes out in October, so it's kind of that 2 months there. August is the time when I really want to start clearing out that standard stuff. And, you know, I go through binders all the time of these people who play seriously and, you know, don't have infinite money. And I'll go through their binder and I'll find a bunch of like Scars dual lands that are, you know, now what, $3 to $5 or whatever they all are. And I'm like, these people are complaining about, you know, standard's too expensive. I don't have the cards to compete. Well, they had these Seachrome Coasts, you know, a year ago when they were $20 a pop, and they just let them sit in their binder. And, you know, now they've come down in price massively. What if 6 weeks before rotation happened, you had traded these for, you know, Innistrad lands, or like you said, the Parallel Lives or something like that. And these are things that you just have to kind of keep on top of it and, you know, tell people, I'm trying to get rid of these cards. Do you want them? And just kind of be direct about it if you have to. But it's very important to clear out your standard stuff year to year and keep it rolling, because if you miss it and rotation happens, you're going to be basically out of luck, because that, you know, 90% of standard, probably higher than that, 95% of standard cards all drop heavily in price after they rotate.
I completely agree, and like as a standard player, I try to keep as much of the play set as I can of standard. But you know, there'll be times like Geese will hit 35, Liliana hit it 35, Thundermaw hit 35. I'll sell cards, I'll sell play sets of these cards, and you know, like Falcon Wrath Aristocrat, just because. So, sure, you may not have certain cards to play some decks, but if you're trying to keep your collection going, you need to get out while those cards are at an all-time high and maximize your potential, your profits that you get, and use those to keep your collection going. So being smart about it and knowing what decks you want to play and selling some cards that you may not need, but knowing that they're at a peak is a good time just, you know, to keep your collection going infinite. You know, that's definitely the way to go.
Absolutely. And one of the other things, talk about, you know, for standard players going from season, well, players in general, I suppose, going from year to year, keeping your collection moving. Because if your collection is not moving, it's stagnating, and that likely means it's losing value unless you're sitting on a bunch of dual lands and whatnot. You know, but say, like, last year, you know, Innistrad lands were all very cheap because people had, you know, other lands to replace them with. They didn't need them. So people weren't playing them, and they were cheap. Now, you just have to – people always look back and say, oh, well, I wish I had known that then. Well, you need to get out of that way of thinking and start looking ahead, and it's okay if you're wrong because – like we're talking about, when you're right, it more than makes up for it. So if you look at something like the shock lands right now, and this is the reason we're always so high on picking them up, is that the price really can't not go much lower. It can maybe go a dollar or two lower when they come in Dragon's Maze, whatever. But realistically, they can't go much lower than they are now. So they're very safe investments to hold on to for next year. And that's the kind of stuff you have to keep in mind when you're, you know, looking at seasonality and moving on, rolling your collection from year to year.
So moving on, you guys want to talk about the decks that were doing well this weekend?
Merfolk.
Merfolk. Never.
Of course.
as much as he's trolling us, that's not the least correct thing he's ever said. There's one particular Merfolk I want to talk about, and that is Prime Speaker Zagana. Prime Speaker was actually a huge player in Indianapolis. A Prime Speaker Bant list came out of nowhere. There were two copies in the top eight, including second place. This is a very mid-rangey, sort of a slower Bant deck. You almost wouldn't recognize it if you compared something like Wolfrun Bant. This has got Angel Serenity, some mana accelerators, it's running four main deck Smiters, got Resto Tusk, and it's got three Prime Speakers. So you're really getting the most out of your Thrag Tusks here with the card draw, the extra life. You know, this is a really Thrag Tusky deck.
And this is a long way from the Bant control that was splashing Drownyard. I mean, I see no Wrath in this list.
No Drownyard. You're just out card advantaging them. You're running a Cyclonic Rift and a lot of Garrix. Between two Garrix, usually it's 3 to 5 copies of between Relentless and Primal Hunter. Relentless being a Garrick that is really fun to flip over and go get Zagana after Zagana if they can deal with them. I think this is you might go to time a little bit more because you don't have the drown yard clock, but you're just going to draw so many extra cards.
But guess what else they don't have and you're not going to draw? Sphinx's Revelation.
Yes, notably zero Sphinx's Revelation, even in the sideboard.
I think really the point of this deck is you can abuse Zagana with Restoration Angel, and Restoration Angel and Thragtusk, obviously, you know, but Restoration Angel doesn't abuse Sphinx's Revelation anymore. So I think you pretty much see Sphinx's Revelation in the Wrath decks and maybe Zagana in the creature decks, which at least for the moment appear to be better positioned.
That's pretty good. And what I really like about it also is the Cavern of Souls. You know, that gives you now uncounterable card draw, some insane possibilities, you know, I mean, counterable Restoration Angels, you could just do insane
this
stuff.
This deck is loaded.
Guys,
three Gavinny Township. I think that is, you know, with the Arbor Elves and the Absence Pilgrims, your mana's not going to be that bad. I think three Gavinny Township says, really don't mind if I draw that Arbor Elf late.
Right, that's a really good point, and I think that helps some of those hands where you maybe flood out with the small guys to keep them competitive. I'm also really excited that I could play Cavern of Souls and Standard and name your folk now.
Yeah, yes, you can. But you would rather do Wizard.
No, I want to.
I would name Wizard so they think you're going to play a Boros Reckoner, but that's just me.
No.
He wants to announce Merfolk. He wants to slam it on the table, windmill.
Okay.
Merfolk on my cavern. Watch out.
Other than your Masters of the Pearl Trident, which are going to be quite good with Zagana running around, I think there are two things to talk about here. The first one is obviously Zagana. This card, what, tanked to $6? It was like a $15-$20 pre-order. Everybody went, yeah, but, you know, whatever. And so it kind of hit 5 or 6. It's actually on its way back up. I could see this card hitting a solid 15 quite easily. This deck is the real deal. The other card I want to talk about is a card we talked about last week as being criminally underpriced. Hope you picked it up. Angel of Serenity.
Yep.
Not only was played in this deck, it was played in the other breakout deck of the weekend. Did we want to talk about that deck?
Yeah, it's...
This is a deck I joked was about 7 cards away from the Seance list Ryan played at States this year, top 8 with. Unfortunately, 4 of the 7 cards it's off by are a 0 copies of Seance in it. But this is a junk-colored Unburial Rites type deck. So it's running the full 4 Unburial Rites to get that sort of, you know, 5-mana Seance effect. It's running, you know, more Angels of Serenity, Pilgrims and... Pilgrims and the other Mana Dork. It's running some Healers, some Crater Hoofs, Lotlith Troll, another card we talked about being criminally cheap and people are brewing with. And, you know, obviously it's running Resto Angel. And then it's got Grisly Salvage, Lingering Souls, Mulch, Rites. I think this deck is quite good, but I've obviously thought this deck is quite good for months because it's really the same shell Ryan was running, which is Mulch and Grisly Salvage.
It's just value. Yeah, it's just a different way of accruing value.
Yep. And then you get... Arrow writes and you get an Angel of Serenity or a Thragtusk and you really just go to town. It's not running the Armada Worm and Trostani and a lot of the stuff that Ryan was using to get huge advantage in his list, but you know, Angel of Serenity is, it's too good not to cheat into play, and running 8 Mana Dorks, some Centaur Healers, Lotlith Trolls, a lot of cheap early stuff, and Link Souls is actually going to be quite good when you manage to reanimate that Crater Hoof. You can go over the top very easily. And this is, you know, Brad Nelson was a big proponent of this deck, and he's always been all about the Craterhoof Behemoth, so it's a good thing he found a list that he wants to run Craterhoof in again, and this deck was all over the top 8 in Rio and Verona at the GPs. So it didn't really end up at Star City in Indianapolis, because I think people were a little more excited about the Bant deck, but it was all over the GPs. So that's 2 decks that are running 3 copies of Angel of Serenity that broke out this weekend, and I really hope you picked up the Angel because it's on its way back up.
Right, I agree. And there's a, you know, one of the other decks I want to touch on is the event that actually won the Star City Open, which was Nia Humans. And the there are a few things notable about this. One, it was main decking 4 Frontline Medics, which is a card that's kind of been in and out of the main decks. More importantly, it was sideboarding the Boros Reckoners, not main decking them, because it really just wanted to overload on the humans in the main deck. And I point this out because Boros Reckoner has fallen below $20 retail some places. And that's something that we predicted a while back, you know, after the card spiked so hard. And it's just maybe more reinforcement. One final reminder, if you have Boros Reckoners, they're probably not going to be any more expensive than they are right now. I mean, the card's probably heading down to $15. So if you still have any and you don't need them and you want to get some value out of them, you're probably best off trading them away now.
Absolutely. I think it spiked so high because it was a combination of this card is so hot and this card is so new. So
right, with especially it, new.
Having four of them, you know, nobody having the potential to have four of them. Everyone was scrambling to pick them up. But now that everyone pretty much that wants them has got them, it's going to – I see it approaching 15. If it continues to see the amount of play it's seeing now, 15 seems pretty healthy, maybe even 10 or 12. But if it falls off a little bit, I could see it even falling below that, especially called, coming up.
Is this called supply and demand?
It needs to be called that, yeah.
I think this is the ceiling. I think if you can still get 25 in trade, you absolutely do that.
Yeah, and I mean, I want to approach this the right way and not in we told you so kind of way. You know, but when this card was moving past $20 and we all said there's no way it's going to hold that price, to be honest, I received a lot of blowback in some circles for that statement because people were just telling me, oh, it's so good, it's so good. You know, but that doesn't trump all the underlying fundamentals of the card. So I just want you to, those of you out there who have been following this kind of the saga of Boros Reckoner, the rise and fall of the card, take this as a lesson going forward of what happens with these cards that spike really hard when they're new. And just remember it the next time it comes around.
Can we name a card that's not playable outside of Standard that spiked when it was new that went above $25? That's a non-mythic. The only one
in my tavern.
Thragtusk, I don't know that Thragtusk ever really went above 25. Like, we could pretend it was 30 on a few sites, but you could still get them for 20 bucks on eBay.
Yeah. Cavern sees play outside of Standard, though, Marcel.
Exactly. Cavern sees play, Liliana sees play, Snapcaster Mage sees play. But if you look at something like Boros Reckoner, this is 100% right now a Standard card. So 25 has got to be the absolute ceiling on a non-mythic, non-eternal playable card. Doesn't matter how hot it is.
I mean, maybe the ceiling is 30, because you can argue if Thragtusk wasn't in a Vintex, it could be 30. I would argue if Thragtusk wasn't in a core set, it wouldn't have been 30 either.
Thragtusk 4 months to be printed in the event deck, though.
Yeah. I mean, so I think, you know, moving forward, I think it's a pretty good estimate that 25 is the absolute ceiling for a Standard-only rare, and that is exceedingly difficult for a card to hit. So yeah, just, you know, a lot of times people ask, you know, where do you guys get your prices? How do you figure out your predictions? And a lot of it's based on historical precedents. And this is a very important one, Boros Reckoner and Thragtusk, that frankly we'll be using for years to come when we, you know, point to price predictions for cards.
Very true. I mean, and not only for knowing what the ceiling is, but also you can really tell the trend on when it's going to drop. I mean, we see how quickly Thragtusk did. Most cards have been known to just kind of slowly drop a little bit. But really, I think Reckoner's going to have the same, you know, $10 hit overnight that Thragtusk did, and not because of an event deck this time around, but because of Redemption. So, you can hold on to him only for so long, but as soon as that Redemption hits, there's no way this card holds 25, not even close.
It's down $6 here in 3 weeks, and it's trending steadily downward. So,
if you'll notice, Cool Stuff Inc. actually has Boros Reckoner on sale, which seems to indicate they probably think they had it at $27, and they seem to indicate that was probably the absolute ceiling. And they're looking to get out of them before they tank a little bit.
Yeah. All right. So do we want to move on into what's at work?
Let's do it.
Okay.
But I'll start you guys off.
All right. Go ahead.
So I'm going to get you guys on Moto Price.
Come on.
But I'm going to give you a little bar, so that way it'll make it a little bit easier.
Okay.
I'm going to do the Liliana of the Veil that I called a while ago to sell at 35. So I said to sell it at 35. What do you think the price is at now?
I actually don't think it went down. I think it's probably about 40 if you're even bringing this up.
38.
Oh.
Wait a minute. I think I was wrong because Marcel isn't the kind of the person to say, hey, I was wrong about this. Marcel seems like the kind of person to say, hey, I told you so. So maybe it tanked, but you know what? I'm sticking with 40.
Yeah, you know, I'll hedge. I'm going to say 28.
Okay, right. This card actually went up to 42.64.
Oh, wow. Oh my
god!
It is the most expensive card in Standard, and I'm getting this from MTG Goldfish. This is a good place for Magic Online prices. I learned this from Maddie Studios from Heavy Meta, and like it does like a good average, you could say. So if you want Moto Price, it's a good play to go there. You guys can see what's going on. But yeah, most expensive card in Standard, Liliana of the Veil. So yeah, I told you to sell at 35. It wasn't bad at the time, but definitely if you would have held on and not sold, now's the time to sell.
All right. I've got one for you guys, and I think I might even stump the pros here. Dark Seal Plate.
$4.
Six, seven?
I'm going to say $8.
It is $3.50 on Cool Stuff. Now, here's the thing. Cool Stuff actually has a very good price because the TCG mid price on this card is $5.07. The card has more than doubled in price in the last month, which I find really interesting. For, you know, for the longest time, this card was a solid $2. I knew it was a dollar bill in cash, you know, and you pick them up as cards to round out trades. I'm not exactly sure why this card has, you know, almost tripled in price now.
It's ridiculous in Commander. I mean, everybody is running.
So, I mean, it's not any more ridiculous now than it was a month ago. So I find this interesting, but I feel like this is probably just a overdue price correction more than anything else, and this will probably continue to be this much money going forward.
Yeah, I could easily see this being $10. I think it's one of the best Commander cards. Like, like you said, I was one of those people that's like, this is always a dollar bill. And then I started looking at it, and I started watching people play Commander, and I was always wondering, like, why in the world is this card worth any money? Then you watch them play in Commander, and, like, everybody has a copy. That's why it's worth money. And if everybody needs a copy, that means the card's probably going up. It's only been printed once. I don't know if foils are way more ridiculous, but that's usually pretty common if the card is, you know, fitting into every Commander deck, and the fact that it's colorless makes it, you know, obviously even more versatile.
Yeah, I think the price correction on this is what makes it really interesting to me, because I honestly, if somebody had, what's it worth this to me, I would have said like $3, because, you know, that's kind of where I figure it's at. So this is really interesting that it's going up. And this is one of those cards, you can see that the rise on it has been gradual. It hasn't been an overnight jump, which is usually indicative of something that's more sustainable as far as cards, you know, rising prices go. If, you know, you're looking at something for speculative purposes. All right, so who wants to go next?
I will go next. So the card in question, as I just picked someone from this collection, is Bloodstained Mire.
That's still, isn't that like 25? I think that's...
Just a regular one, right?
Yep, just a regular Bloodstained Mire.
I
think they probably went up, because I want to say that since, like, Polluted Delta hit, like, 60 or 70, and Flooded Strand hit, like, 60 or 70 or something, like, god-awful... I got to say, Bloodstained Mire's got to be at least $35.
Yeah, I would say 40.
Okay. Bloodstained Mire, there are two copies in stock, but they are played, and those are at $32.49. The Near Mint ones are sold out at $36 on Cool Stuff. So, I mean, yes, like you said, the card has actually just doubled in the past couple of months. It was always like $18 to $20. It was the worst of the fetches. Yeah. And then the Zendikar fetches all went up and went above the price of Bloodstained Mire, which obviously... The market corrected itself eventually, and people realized it was incorrect because they're far easier to obtain than the old ones. And then, of course, Jund starting to see more play in Legacy, I believe, increased the price even further.
Badlands is actually the hottest duel right now. It actually went up from being around 30-ish, and it's around 60 now. So it's punishing Jund and those sort of builds that are making Bloodstained Mire and Badlands both go up.
Absolutely.
Wooded Foothills is out of stock. I had Cool Stuff at 35, which is another one I recall not very long ago being like 28. So
yep.
Well, Foothills actually got played in Maverick, so it didn't go up quite as fast as Windswept Heath, but it still.
I don't know that it got played. It got played in Punishing Maverick, yeah. And yeah.
Thank you for not correcting me on my own deck list. That would have been silly.
For a minute. But yeah, it was played in Zoo and all of that stuff too when that was a deck. But yeah, so it looks like these are all kind of on the upswing.
Okay, we talked a lot earlier about stuff that rotates. One thing I like to do is I like to trade competitive cards off of casual players and casual cards off of competitive players. Not necessarily exploiting those players' blind spots, but really you're taking cards they value less. Competitive players aren't going to care about casual stuff. They just want to get those competitive cards. And casual players really don't want the competitive stuff. They would rather have something cool like Celestial Mantle. So a card I like to target out of both players' binders, rotated a long time ago, doesn't see much play anymore. I wonder if you can tell me how much we would expect to pay on Cool Stuff for a Void Slime.
Ooh,
that's a good one. I'm going to guess, I think Bylist is like $3.50 or $4, so my guess that'd be like $6 or $7.
Yeah, I was going to say $6.
$8.
Solid, guys. Very solid. Good Bylist extrapolation there, Ryan. Corbin, you nailed it. It's actually $6 even on Cool Stuff, Inc. This is a great card to take out of people's binders because it never was $1 million when it was in Standard, and how could it be worth more now that it's rotated? So a lot of people just kind of have one of these chilling in their binder when they had it back in the day, And you can get these for pretty cheap, and it's a solid, you know, $6 on the outs, or if you want to buy listed, it's a good $3.54, which is, actually, it's a pretty good margin on that to get $4 for a $6 card. So this is something I really like to target in people's binders. Some of the leeches that are around $5 or $6, very similar, but not a lot of people know that this is $6, so you guys nailed it.
Yeah, this is another card that for a very long time sat around $4 and just this year has gone up a couple bucks. So it's really starting to see, you know, maybe it's interest with new Ravnica stirring up interest in cards from old Ravnica. I don't know, but we're seeing.
I think it is.
There's been
I think
a
it's
lot of movement.
Crash giving us some interesting cards to run as generals.
Right. And so, people bring attention to Simic, so people want to make, you know, blue-green decks. They go look for cool cards. They find this. Yeah.
And Void Slam is amazing in EDH. It does a lot of work. And 3-mana is not hard to hold up in EDH, too. So I think a renewed interest in playing Simic colors in EDH has probably been good to this card. And just time. You know, it's going to go up because it's old.
How much are the promos of the full art ones?
You know, I couldn't tell you. They're sold out at 40. But I want to say that these are, you know, maybe a good 50, 60 bucks on the eBay. It's a really, really good looking card. It was original art on Void Slime, but they just blew it up, showed more of it. And, you know, I really like that style. They didn't do those cards for long, but it was like the full art and foil, but they printed the text like superimposed in white over the full art. And they just look gorgeous. I really like how this promo Void Slime looks.
Yeah, I agree. All right. Now, so is there anything else we want to hit on this week? Anyone have anything?
Let's see. I think we probably don't want to overwhelm anyone with trade facts for the first week. And I think from here on out, we'll probably throw a couple of things in. Maybe not necessarily every show, but, you know, anything that we think about, we'll talk about a little bit. You know, and remember that we do have people that are just getting into, you know, trading, especially being on Gathering Magic now and having some new listeners that may not have been immersed into this before. But I think from now, we're probably good.
Yeah, and if you know, you guys have any more requests, anything specific, topics you want us to talk about, feel free to shoot us an email, hit us up on Twitter, request if you don't want us to read your comment on the air, so to speak.
No fetal positions anymore, please.
Please, no dead cats either, unless, I mean, that was pretty funny, but please, no.
I have somebody protesting, actually. We have a live cat here on the microphones. If you can hear that, he doesn't like reading comments about dead cats, so let's keep that to a minimum.
Yeah, poor Steve.
All right, well, this is Brainstorm Brewery, episode number 44. Check us out next week. Later.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
See you.
Good night, Canada.
I'm just holding his face up next to the microphone.
That was the perfect end of the cast right there.
Brainstorm Brewery is brought to you by GatheringMagic.com and CoolStuffInc.com. Show your support.